And now we're going to hear from Billy, who is best known for her role as the visionary founder of the Black Women's Health Project, which is now the Black Women's Health Imperative. Billy is also a co-founder of Raising Women's Voices, and she'll talk about what do we need to do next to make us not only have access, but care that meets our needs.
Thank you, Cindy. Good afternoon, everybody. Hey, how are y'all doing out there? You all right? You hanging in here? You know, one of the biggest challenges we had was doing healthcare reform is this real wonky kind of thing, you know, and it can be a bit dry. So it takes a lot to make it interesting, especially for somebody like me, because I kind of go all glassy-eyed when we start talking all of the policy and all that kind of stuff. So I have to look for ways to make it challenging and interesting and thinking that there's probably somebody else out there like me. I was just sitting here thinking about 2005 when we were over at Simmons College in Boston. We had the very first meeting, first conference of Raising Women's Voices, where we brought in folks from reproductive health organizations, women's organizations, to really do a healthcare reform 101. Because most of the folks had not been paying any attention to it. They had absolutely no idea the impact that it could have on our lives. And it was a good thing we did, because later on when the Nelson Amendment came up and all those other guys that came up with their amendments to block reproductive health services, we were there to band together to make them not be quite as bad as they are now. So I'm going to just talk some about how do we move beyond what do we need to do next about health equity, because I'm getting sort of tired of us beating up on the people for having all these high statistics, when in fact it has a lot to do with a lot of institutionalized racism that exists in our society. And unless we are being willing to dismantle some of this, we're still going to have it. I think the guy yesterday on the stage, what's his name, Stephen Bradley, the head of the Massachusetts Public Health Association, he made a statement, you know, white folks like me who have benefited from all of the years of slavery and racism in America. And I thought, yeah, you're absolutely right. You're standing on all of these people's shoulders. And then as Cindy was talking about the states without Medicaid expansion, in a few, I call them the slave states. And they still are the states where people have really bad health disparities, and I don't know why we haven't risen up and done something about it. It's just maddening to me for us to be ranked so low in terms of getting health care to people, and have these governors from these states with these states where there are large numbers of poor people who are sick and not wanting to do anything about it. And you let a dog get maimed by somebody, like this dog that was maimed here called, I can't remember, some dog got really punished, and that football player who punished the dogs, and people were all in the streets, and nobody's doing anything about people who are doing it, not even abused children, or not even children not yet born, or not those born who are here. So we need to start caring about people too. And I'm not saying I'm not an anti-animal person, but I'm also a people person, and I care about us. So one of the first things we got to do is really look at our politicals, our public officials. We have got to start, y'all, this is no joke, we've got to start electing people who have good common sense and people who put public health first. And whether they're Republican, whether they're Democrat, whether they whatever, they need to put public health first. We shouldn't have to worry about whether or not we can get health care, because we should have officials who care. And I say to young people, you all consider running for office, and I use the example of Marianne. Marianne is on the school board in Freehold, right? And she's learning the down and dirty, the good and the bad, and all the thing about politics. And I hope one day we hear that the Mariannes of the world are running for some of these offices so that we can get our country back. I want my country back. Just like the others, I don't know what country they want, but I know the one that I want. One of the best things that's happened with the Affordable Care Act has been the funding of community health centers, because community health centers don't turn anybody away, and that's where a lot of undocumented people and other people who've been disenfranchised by this wonderful country we live in can go and get their health care. Now, one of the first things we have to do is close the gap for health insurance coverage. In Massachusetts, they pretty much closed the gap between everybody except the undocumented. And that's only because we have a ruling that undocumented people, for some reason, cannot buy health care, not even with their own cash money, which is something I don't understand. There's just a certain meanness there and a certain xenophobia that just does not need to exist, and we need to rise up and challenge that. And I don't know if we can wait till 2020 or something like that, when we people of color become the majority. I don't know if we can wait until that late to have it happen. We need to rise up now, because there are a lot of right-thinking white people, as well as right-headed white people, as well as right-headed, left-headed, you know what I mean, who can make this a reality. Now, we're talking about people getting health insurance, so we need to talk about health insurance literacy. I don't know about you, but when it was time for me, when I went on Medicare, and then it was time for me to get a supplement. And when I went to look at on the computer to try to deal with figuring out what kind of supplemental health plan I wanted, I'm telling you, it was difficult. And like Cindy said, her husband just handed it to her. Well, me and my partner, she's got a DRPH, and we sat there, and we could not figure this sucker out. And I'm saying, what is Miss Sally going to do? You know? And I couldn't understand. There's the silver plan, the bronze plan, the whatever plan, and all of these words that I didn't know. And you want to get the right thing. And I'm going to tell you, the honest to God, what I did. I had a friend who I trusted, who had been doing it for 2 or 3 years. I called her up and said, what plan do you have? And when she told me what plan she got, that's the one I bought, and that's the one I still have. I haven't figured it out. I got around it. But what we got to do is look this thing in the face, and we got to start educating people about insurance. And one of the things we have to demand, something that bothers me, is that papers that affect our lives, our legal papers, our deeds, our wills, all these things are written in a language that we don't understand. You can read it, and you don't know what in the world it said. These things affect our lives. And there's a woman in England who has started a movement demanding that all of our documents be written in plain English so that we can understand and know what they mean. But now we've got to take this bull by the horn and start teaching women, how do you know what you need in a plan? How do you do some analysis of where your family is? How much can you afford to not have the gold plan? Do you have enough money? Because the lower they go, the more, the higher you the deductible. What is a deductible? You know, what is a copay? What do all these words mean? Folks have got to be taught that, because 85% of us get health care through the employer, and they pick out the plan. They pick out the plan and say, okay, we got Blue Cross this year, next year we got Aetna, next year we got so-and-so and so, and you got to go along with whatever the coverage. But now you have to determine between all of these different plans, the other 15% of the people. So there has to be some education. We have to also remember to do continue health literacy. health literacy is still very important. People have to be able to understand what is wrong with them, and even when they're reading their policies, what's covered, they need to know what the diseases are, etc. One thing about health literacy and what is happening with us as a population, it seems as if over the years, we are now having to dumb down everything. I wrote something the other day and someone sent it back to me and said, you can't use this, it's written at the 12th grade level, and it should be now. I thought it was the 7th grade level you're supposed to write at. Now they're saying that's the 6th grade level. So what are we going to be doing in 10 years, writing at the 1st grade level? Doesn't it make sense to somebody that we educate the public and bring them up? So instead of us going down, somebody needs to take that bull by the horn again and do something about it. This work needs to start with young people in high school. We used to have health education. That was a subject that we went to every single day. We went to health education. So what are they teaching in health education? This needs to become a part of the curriculum so that when folks get to be adults, all of this is not a surprise to them. And quite frankly, we absolutely need a more educated population than we have now. Now, some of the things we need to think about is this whole concept of personalized medicine. And as personalized medicine, as they start doing research and finding out drugs and treatments that work on different ethnic populations, we as people of color especially need to participate in the clinical trials leading to this. We are not there. So they're not going to have anything that works especially for us. They're going to have it for a bunch of white people who are in it, but we won't be in it. And we cannot always, we got to move past our suspicion of the Tuskegee, the whole Tuskegee experiment. We got to move past that and really know that we can look at informed consent forms, make sure that they say what they're supposed to say, and when you get there, you don't have to sign them the minute they give them to you. You can take them home with you and study them and get someone to help you look over them. And I say to people, one good thing to always have is have a nurse as a friend. Because nurses can understand this stuff, and they'll have time to talk to you and tell you about it. And if you don't have one as a friend, and you go to a church, they have health committees, there are nurses there. I just stand up and say, is there a nurse in the place? I need a nurse to help me figure this out. And nurses are always available. They'll always help you. Remember that. Always have a nurse as a friend. You can call them in the middle of the night. They'll answer the phone. They'll talk to you. They'll help you figure it out. The last thing I want to talk about is, do y'all know anything about patient portals? You do? Oh, good. Okay, good. I just learned about them. I went to my health center to have my mammogram the other day, and so they said, well, do you want to join our patient portal? Well, I sit on the board of this health center, so I knew this thing was supposed to be coming, but I hadn't experienced it. So I signed up, and on my cell phone, I have all of my medications that I take. I have all of my diagnosis from my last visits. I have all my lab reports. I have all my appointments. And this is coming down the line. Now, I had to kind of chuckle to myself because I'm old and I've been around a while. And in the 70s, we were a part of those crazy women who were demanding that we have access to our medical records. And the doctors were refusing. They did not want us to see what was on our records. And the more they didn't want us to see, the more we wanted to see. Now, they're giving them to you. They're begging you, take them. Because what we said then is true. The more informed we are, the better we take care of ourselves. And so when we have this information ourselves, we know what the deal is, and we can be active participants rather than passive receivers. And so as we start to participate, we can question, We can be a part of it, and that alone is a wonderful skill that we then have to start to teaching people who are just coming into the healthcare system, who haven't even been able to ask for their records or know what sent them because they didn't have insurance to get there. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the Second Bill of Rights, left us unfinished with the right to health. And that was because of a deal that he cut with the southern states because they were all crazy around slavery and all of what they've done. And that's why it is not within the Constitution that we have a right to health. But we do. And we do by dint of our birth. And we do because we believe that health is a human right. And what we need to do is go back to what I said earlier, because a lot of getting rid of health disparities and promoting health equity has to do with institutionalized racism. How do we dismantle a lot of what is happening that's keeping us from getting there, like having money so that folks can have grocery stores, so that we can make sure that we bring in grocery stores for folks, that there'll be green spaces to walk around in, that we have safe neighborhoods, that we get rid of the rats and the roaches and all of that out of people's houses, that there's good housing. All of these things help. And in that way, instead of always beating up on the individual and making us feel bad because I've got diabetes or because my asthma won't go away, we need to start doing all of these other structural things that help make us a whole healthy population. Thank you.
Okay, we ended early on purpose to have time for a conversation with you, and we are really flexible. We can respond to anything, including criticism, you know, challenging feedback, questions, and don't censor yourself. If you have a question that you think is ignorant, somebody else has it. So we'll open it up. I will repeat things, though, because they told us we were taping. Yeah. So the question is, can you enroll in through different mechanisms in every single state?
Yeah, so everyone will be able to enroll online. If you are in a state marketplace, your state has a website that you can go to. If your state did not choose to open a marketplace, you can apply via healthcare.gov. So, as the news reports have shown, that site is being inundated with millions of people. So, you know, on an off chance, maybe you'll be able to get in, but there is a chance that you won't be able to enroll in online. There are phone numbers, both for state marketplaces and for the federal marketplace as well. Now, when it comes to enrolling in person, that's a little bit trickier. So states all have navigators. However, on the federal level, because there's so many states that chose not to have marketplaces, they have navigators, but they may not be in every pocket of the state. So like in New York, we have at least two navigators in every single county in New York State. That's not really going to be possible with the 26 states that are now being federally facilitated. So like we, for example, in Michigan, they have Michigan Consumers for Healthcare Coverage is one of the navigators. However, Michigan's very big. So, you know, if, you know, Jane in, you know, some small pocket of Michigan may not have someone in her specific community, but there are navigators in.
More questions? Perspectives? Yeah.
So you were talking about doing some kind of assessment of are there enough LGBT-friendly providers or where can women get contraceptive coverage? Can you talk about sort of the process of assessing the different plans and helping people in each state?
So the question is that Marianne's recommendation from Raising Women's Voices is that in each state that women or women's groups really deeply assess the plans. Are there enough LGBT culturally competent providers? Are there enough providers of reproductive health services? So the question is, how would you do something like that?
So we have a couple states that where we have regional coordinators. This is something that they're looking to do in the next couple of months. And for example, in New York, we are convening the LGBT task force, which we lead. And this month, we're all going to get together in person.
Next month November, is now this month.
We're all going to get together in person and sit down with all the different health insurance plans and look at the benefits provided. In our task force, we have both people who are advocates for LGBT health, but we also have some of the community health centers that have historically served LGBT populations. So we have both providers, we have patient advocates, we have nurses. So everyone's going to come to the table, look at these plans, and kind of see, are there certain plans that aren't covering services that trans people use in transition? The same thing's going to be done in Illinois for reproductive health as well. They're going to sit down with the Reproductive Health Coalition and look at all the plans to look at the provider networks. Do you see an insurance plan that refuses to include Planned Parenthood in their network? Well, let's look at the places where Planned Parenthood clinics served. A lot of them are underserved areas. Are they including other reproductive health providers in that area? And if not, you can look to see if there's pockets that aren't covered by insurance plans. So those are two examples.
Yeah, with the yellow shirt.
So I come from a slightly less than progressive state, Georgia, that is not expanding Medicaid. However, in some conversations with the governor's staff, they have a perspective that they'll share sort of obliquely that, we know probably that really would be a good thing. But this is political. So this is the view of some people who view poverty as a character flaw.
Right.
So what I would just say to you, for you and your network of folks, one of the things that some folks I'm working with, an organization I'm working with, are doing is talking to those folks in the far-flung counties who the governor depends on for votes and people they depend on for donations. It's a very slow process, but you learn some very interesting things in those sort of one-on-one conversations. Folks who know me know that I've never been about shaming politicians for a good cause. And it's you get some very useful information, and if you look at it the right way and aggregate it the right way, it can come in handy. We haven't changed anything, obviously. But it's a process that we hope will bear some fruit.
Yeah. So I'll recap that really briefly, which is one of the audience members shared in the state where she's in, where Medicaid expansion hasn't yet happened. They are doing a slow strategy to talk to people on whom the governor relies for votes and money. And so this is not to say it's a partisan effort, but it's an effort that a communication strategy consulting firm would describe as assessing your target and understanding who makes the decision, that's your target, in this case the governor, who can get to the decision maker. So in your case, going around and talking to the people on whom the governor relies on for money and votes, and also what is the message that works. So we feel like we've done a little bit of generic research that is a starting point for states where the political establishment is not yet ready to expand Medicaid, and it's don't lead with the word Medicaid. Right, the audience member is nodding her head. Yes, that's right. You might have noticed, I said, take the money that's on the table. Take the money that's on the table is a phrase that's been tried and it works. Not that it instantly changes the political establishment in a resistant state, but repeating it and framing it that way It will start to be picked up by others. It starts to get into an echo chamber. Now I hear people who I know are not connected with our network say things like, this brings our money back to our state. That's another message that works. This makes sense for our state. It's a pretty slow process, and you know, I described a build pressure from the outside strategy, which in some states is possible because there are such an unusual and broad array of potential allies. But your strategy is really smart, too, because if the politics of the situation are such that a governor might even like to resist even more pressure because it sort of burnishes his credibility and maybe he's thinking either about higher office or about a tough primary. And so seeming like I stand up to those kind of people who want to give away health care, the strategy I described might not be the best or the only way to get there. And the strategy you describe is very smart. So thanks for bringing it up. More comments, questions? Yeah, blue shirt. The question was broader recommendations for media campaigns to address women. Well, you know, we certainly wish that the White House, when it finally rolls out the paid ads, wouldn't just be running them at NASCAR or wouldn't just be looking to basketball players as message delivers. It's great that they're there, but we would like some gender equity in those kind of big paid-for high-profile targeting, and we'll keep advocating for that. But in addition, the reason why I turned to Marianne is Marianne worked directly with the people who helped develop this campaign, and maybe you want to say, there's a little more you want to say about message to
the
women?
The two Women for Healthcare sheets are all based in messaging that was tested for women specifically, and so if you look at the type of generic, like plain, easy to understand messaging that we use, that's been tested. A lot of the values that women that connect with women are security, financial security, medical security, peace of mind. And depending on what subsection of women you're talking about specific services actually helps too. So if you're talking about to younger women, talking about contraception health is effective. If you're talking to older women, talking about some of the cancer screenings, talking about some of the benefits to Medicare can even help as well. If you're interested in more about messaging, just give me your email afterwards, and I can forward you some of the actual messaging compasses that we use.
And the other thing is expect the struggle, because even though you're working with people who want to develop the messages, you still have to struggle with them to develop the messages that you think will work or that you know will work because you know that women want it. It's not easy, is what I'm saying. They're not saying, oh, thank you, and then going and doing it. You have to struggle.
So Marianne mentioned giving you her email. Olivia, who's in the back of the room, is going to stand up now and hold up the bright pink email sign-up sheets. Please, please, please give us your email. We will send you... Pass it around. Why don't you start it around now? I'll see your hand. We send one e-newsletter a week, and it's chock full of useful information in easy-to-use format. So we'd really love to have all of you receiving it. And you had your hand up. Yeah. So the question is about what can be done for the tragic reality of millions of women and men are falling through the cracks because they are newcomers and they're not documented. What are we doing? What can be done? What are others doing? Do either of you want to jump to that?
I can talk.
No,
On the state-specific level, all of our coordinators agree. I mean, this is a problem that shouldn't be a problem, but unfortunately is an issue we have to deal with. Speaking from my experience in New York, one of the things we've been pushing for a model policy is that our marketplace will have, it will be no wrong door. So anyone who comes to our marketplace can go through the screening process to see if they're eligible for something. If someone who's undocumented comes to New York's marketplace, they don't leave with nothing in hand. In our marketplace, our state has said that undocumented immigrants can pre-qualify for emergency Medicaid in the marketplace. So it's not just that they're going there and being denied, you know, they won't be able to buy health insurance on the marketplace, but they can enroll in programs if they end up in an emergency room and end up needing medical care. They can do that as well. Unfortunately, it's a very tricky thing to message. You know, we out in the field have been talking to immigrants who are documented that are hearing from their media, from New York One, from, you know, public access shows, not public access, but from cable TV news channels, that if they come to New York State of Health, our marketplace, that we will use this that the state will use this information for immigration enforcement purposes. So when we're out in the field, you know, you're getting people who are afraid to give us their contact information, who, you know, absolutely shut down as soon as we see this because they heard that that we'll be deporting them or giving them to the INS, and that's just not true. And so with a lot of the undocumented immigrant populations, what we've been trying to do is to partner with their trusted communicators. So a lot of times it's a faith-based organization or it's a community-based organization that specifically targets immigrants in the community. And through them, working with them to develop presentations to figure out how can we get them the information, the accurate information they need to know that they can still come to the marketplace, and if they can't enroll in a plan, they can still pre-qualify for programs that they're eligible for.
So that's a state response. Go ahead, Billy.
We have to really work for is immigration reform.
Right.
So that people can see the power of the community. And it changes at the ballot box and the vote and who is in office. And as part of that, as people of color, you know, claim their power, use their voting power, then we can make changes that we won't have to piecemeal and back into things so much. So the first thing is we've got to get some kind of immigration reform going on. That has to happen. And all these little blimps we get in the road and all these little bumps and delays are just keeping it from not happening. But people got to keep the pressure on for immigration reform.
Okay, I have 2:00 by my watch, so we'll officially end the session. 3 of us aren't going anywhere. Our materials in the back. Please pick up materials, sign up for the e-newsletter, come up and talk to us, and thank you for your interest and the work you do on these issues.